Hey guys, it's Katie and Mandy. Welcome to the Dirty Britches minisode. Good morning, or whenever it is when I finally get this edited and uploaded and you listen to it. I don't even know why I say a time frame.
Public thank you to you
morning for us.
For always doing that. I do nothing. I just show up here. My end of the bargain was to keep our website updated, and I have failed miserably at that. I always have.
You did a really good job in the beginning.
For a while.
It was wonderful, but it's so much work.
It's not even like that much work. It's like I just have to sit down and do it. So I know I'm like way backed up.
We have ADHD, as we have discussed previously. Adult-diagnosed ADHD and there are problems with that. So
it's fine. Okay. It is on my to-do list. In my mind, it's like I haven't – somehow I don't have to feel 100% guilty because I haven't completely taken it off my to-do list. So if it's somewhere on there, you know, I can feel like, oh, don't worry, I'll get to it 6 years later, you know.
Along with my 8,000 unread emails in
my inbox. I'll get to that too. Let me tell you, I'm using my husband's computer for this. His inbox, let me open it up. It has like 4 unread emails. Mine has 11,339 emails in the inbox. And to tell you right now, I'm never going to get to those. You know, like not going to happen. Most of them are spam. I don't know how he avoids getting so much spam, but it's it's, you know, listeners or whatever. You know,
everything you signed up for. 8 million political emails, like some senator from North Dakota, who you never even heard of. Somehow we got on their list. I don't know.
I'm a sucker for signing up for things too. Like we went to this like home and garden show that was in the big like auditorium place in our city, and they had all these raffles, and I was like, sure, like a raffle. Yeah. That's a great idea. Sign up, not realizing like, of course I'm giving, you know, like how dumb am I? You know, that is like marketing 101. And so then there was like a water vacuum company that was like, you won. And I was like, yay, I've never won anything for a raffle. This is so exciting. And Heath is like, it is a ploy. Everyone wins. Then you have to sit through the like 2-hour demonstration where they come to your house and do the water vacuum. At which point I was like, that vacuum looks amazing. And he's just like, stop. No, we can not participate in this charade any longer. No more raffles. So anyway,
Well, my downfall is that the Instagram algorithms know me, as we know.
Course.
They're right in my brain.
Yeah.
And everything they put up on there, I'm an ad. I'm just like, oh, that does look helpful. Or I did want that. Or
of course you did.
I could use that.
And this is why I'm on like zero social media, because I know it would just suck me into so many holes. Yes. Well, I did for this today, of course, like for our work, I will look up stuff and watch things on social media. And I did get sucked into some rabbit holes that I think we're going to have to just spend like entire episodes on. But we had there. So there we are recording this not terribly long after the State of the Union address and the response to the State of the Union address, which is always done by the other party of whoever the president is. Mm-hmm. And this year, it was the Republicans' turn to do the response, since Joe Biden is a Democrat. I hope I'm not giving anybody new information. That's all very basic. And it was Katie Britt, a senator from Alabama. And I don't, like, there's so much has been said about how so bananas her response was. And if people have not actually watched it yet, in fact, you sent it to me like minutes after, you know, like, oh my gosh, we've got to talk about this. And I almost didn't watch it because I thought, oh, I bet I know what it sounds like. Like how, like, sure, I can imagine what it is. And then I listened to it and I was like, oh no, in my wildest dreams, I did not expect that to be the speech.
No, it was not on the bingo card whatsoever. And there have been some really, really, as you said, great responses and parodies, and Scarlett Johansson on SNL being like the greatest. So don't trouble your mind with the original response if you haven't seen it, but go watch Scarlett Johansson's because it's hysterical and it's pretty spot on. I think
you have to watch the original before you... My husband was watching the SNL version first and I was like, no. You have to watch the real one because it is so... It's almost like Scarlett Johansson is toned down. Like, it's almost like the satire is when you're trying to satirize something that's that ludicrous, the satire almost becomes like the straight man version of whatever you're doing. So anyway, yes, what I was really, really struck by was how, not that I think Katie Britt listens to this podcast or, you know, knows what we're up to. She does not care. But this season, we're focusing on the weaponization of motherhood by white women. And that speech to me was like, oh, wow. If you're teaching a class on this topic, that is like
just the embodiment,
the perfect primary source to show people. It was like the graphic imagery, what's the line about the blood? Like our country is steeped in the blood of like, at night, I teach my kids.
Patriots.
Some like.
To the blood of
like,
patriots.
I teach my kids that our country is steeped in the blood of patriots. And it's like the creepiest, like just so graphic and violent and like very, you know, she's in the kitchen. All of the things that people have criticized for. But what I was most struck by was, wow, this is ground zero in our current moment of exactly what we're trying to unpack and learn more about is how mothers, especially white women, weaponize motherhood for really terrible ends. And she framed the entire speech as like, I'm a mom and I'm in the kitchen and, you know, I see you and I hear you and this will not stand, the blood of our patriots, blah, blah, blah. I couldn't believe how perfectly aligned it was with what we're trying to learn about this season.
Yeah. I mean, I think like there's so many different parts of it we can break down. And I know we were talking before I went down one path, you went down looking at another path. But I think just first, the very first basic level of breaking it down to here's a woman who has the responsibility of the national Republican response to the president's State of the Union address, which is a huge deal.
Right.
And if you go back and you look at her bio, she's an attorney. She graduated from law school. She practiced law. She then became the first elected woman senator from Alabama, who is a female. Mm-hmm.
The youngest woman ever elected.
Yeah.
To Senate.
I think she was the second youngest from what I read. But anyway, one of the two.
Yeah.
So the youngest Republican woman elected U.S. senator.
Sure.
The second youngest woman overall, the first one was a Democrat, Blanche Lincoln, was in 1998. Okay. So she has like broken all these boundaries, had all these responsibilities. The point being, she's the representative for this kind of like Christian woman, mother sitting in the kitchen when she has clearly benefited from all of the women that have gone before her to break down all of these barriers that would have kept her from ever getting to where she currently was. And I think that's one of the main underlying things about this weaponization of motherhood. These women, particularly white women, who are arguing for going back to this traditional role of womanhood and motherhood and being a wife in the home. None of them live that life. She clearly doesn't live that life. She's in D.C., like in the Senate. She was in law school. She was at a law firm. Like she doesn't, that's not who she is either. It's like this image that's being sold.
Yeah.
I think that's like the main thing that you see first.
It reminds me so much of the anti-suffragists, like all these women who are going around public speaking about why women shouldn't have any political voice. Like the irony is just so intense. Yeah. I was thinking about that too. Like I am a mom who also does paid work outside of the home. And I am always a mom. It's not just when I'm in my house, like in my kitchen, literally cooking my kids dinner. Like it is always interesting to me how momness is even framed, like where it's located or when it's appropriate to talk about, because I'm never not a mom. Like everything I do is connected to that. So it's just, I don't know, like even if she had wanted to, and in her campaign, like I was looking back, I didn't really know very much about her. I feel like we're kind of like weirdly alternate universe versions of each other. We both are named Katie. Mm-hmm. We both were born in early February in the 1980s. Mm. So my fellow Aquarian brunette white woman, just very different in every other regard. But she was like president of the student body of the University of Alabama, like all these, you know, clearly political ambitions. I was looking at all of her old ads for when she was running for office. There's the Iowa State University Archives of Women's Political Communication is a really interesting database. You can look up like people's speeches, people's campaign ads, women from throughout U.S. history. And she's got like the titles of her ads are Back the Blue, Fight for Life, Paying the Price, New Blood for Alabama, What Alabama is Made Of, Your Word is Your Bond, Monopoly Money, which is like kids playing Monopoly in the background. And she's criticizing the Democrats for spending the taxpayers' dollars as if it's Monopoly money. Secure the Border, Shoot Straight, which is literally her shooting a gun. No balanced budget, no paycheck. She talks about like in her campaign that her being a mom is why she ran for office, why she does all these things. Great. Sure. I understand that. What I don't understand is why then that has to be relegated to a certain geographic location in your house and like it with a certain outfit and like a certain tone of voice. One of the social media rabbit holes I went down was former trad wives who were involved in like white Christian nationalist communities who've left and are like exposing what they were trained to do and how they were like the cult of this community and what they were inculcated in. And
we're going to do like a whole episode on the trad wife.
We have to.
Thing.
It is.
Yeah. And so for anyone who is unaware of this, because I had not heard of this until just a few months ago, the whole trad wife thing is basically, when you boil down to it, like returning to this in-house, taking care of the children, baking granola bars from scratch, I don't know, kind of a thing. And it's this whole movement. Do you know, like, when did this become social media movement?
I don't
know.
We really do need to set aside an entire episode because there's so much about it. There's so much about it. The social media, like, vloggers that I was watching to prep for today were talking about the role of the voice and that there's like a part of being trained to be a trad wife is vocal training. So they had like all sorts of different names for it. Keep Sweet was one that I'd heard before when I watched like the Duggars documentary or whatever. But it's like keeping your voice like really like this and never raising your voice and staying really calm and just being, it's like a baby voice almost.
This softness.
Right.
We'll get into more
about this. Like there was a lot to unpack with just the voice. So I think we should save more of that for the episode. But the unpacking this woman was doing of Katie Britt's speech was doing comparisons of other public speaking that she has done as a senator and in her campaign and how different vocally she was in this speech to like very intentionally tap into this trad wife community, whatever. So there's like levels of stuff. It reminds me when you are able to notice Mormon coded stuff because of your background. Mm-hmm. But I just see a picture of kids with a flag running through a field of wildflowers. Like it doesn't trigger any information for me because I don't know the context. It's the same way as this. Like I wouldn't have known like, oh no, her vocal choice was a choice for a reason. And this is what it's connected to. All of that is just so interesting. I really tried to learn more about her. She wrote a book, I know that, about her upbringing. Mm-hmm. What's it called? God Calls Us to Do Hard Things, Lessons from the Alabama Wiregrass. Apparently, she talks about this in a campaign ad that she worked in her family's hardware store, I think, starting at 7. And I was like, oh, are you endorsing child labor? Like that, you know, like that taught her lessons about how to, you know, budget things. And she did inventory or whatever. I don't know. I thought that was interesting. Her husband played for the Patriots was an NFL player. They've got two kids. I think their kids' names are Bennett and Ridgeway. And then that's it. I really like I couldn't find out more than that, you know. So
yeah, I'm sure that there's been more written like in the past couple of weeks, but I didn't get like too deep into her life other than my normal Wikipedia search. Basically, it seems like has been pretty non-traditional as far as like the female roles go ever since she was young. So it's an interesting paradox. But I think like, and that's pointed out in some of the other critiques, I think, of this white women female movement that we started talking about.
One thing when I was looking at her political ads, you can watch them at this political archives and you can read the transcripts. And there's this, like, she and her husband, he's a lobbyist now and worked for like an economic development agency. She has worked like on campaigns as a chief of staff. Like you said, she was a lawyer. But this one ad, I mean, it's very, very clear. It's over and over in her campaign materials that she is running because she's a mom fighting to protect her kids' future in America. Like that's the very clear message. So this one ad that's called New Blood for Alabama that was run on June 6th, 2022. She says, I'm a 40-year-old mother of two, and I believe if my generation doesn't wake up and step up, our kids won't have the opportunity to live their American dream. That's why I'm running this race. As your senator, I'll defend our Christian conservative values, and I will always put Alabama and America first. I'm Katie Britton. I approve this message. If you're looking for new blood to shake things up in Washington and fight for Alabama, I'd be honored to earn your vote. There's just a lot of that language, like the future. And here it's very clear, like our Christian conservative values, our kids won't have the opportunity. Like who is our there is clearly like a narrow group. But it, yeah, this, I think your point about this person who hasn't lived this trad wife life of like a stay at home mom, you know, that is, she is tapping into all of this as, and clearly being positioned by the party as like a symbol to try to attract other women, white women specifically. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think that tension is there,
but it's so much.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's so much in that language and the way that it's put out there that I think just taps into the guilt of motherhood. Like, if you don't do this, if you don't get on board and jump into this realm of things, you are going to fail your children, which I think is like every mother's fear, regardless of what, like what political biases they have. And so part of it's just like another manipulative move to kind of take over and position themselves as the people who really care about kids, who really want what's best. And if you're going to be on the side of kids and mothers, that's the only side that there is, which is just like brilliant messaging, but also bullshit. So
I mean, there was some place I saw that, God, this is like, so like I read somewhere, I sound like a, you know, like the old aunt who's like screaming about things at a potluck, that it was something about Trump's first fundraising email that went out after Katie Britt's State of the Union response. And it was like, you know, please donate. And, you know, if this isn't the right time for your family, I understand, take care of your family. Yeah. And you're just like, what? No, it's just all such garbage. And I think there's clearly like, who gets to count? I think that's the whole point of the weaponization of white motherhood is who gets to count as a mom and whose kids matter most and what are we even protecting them from? Like, I think the women activists who are also mothers that I admire a lot are like absolutely doing their work in anti-racism or, you know, anti-oppressive, whatever, justice-based movements are doing it out of like a passion and love for children, whether it's their own children or children in their community, like all children. And so this, it's like a, when both sides say they have the same, not that there's only two sides, but when people are saying like, I'm doing this for the children, and then they have such radically different policies that they're advocating for, like something is amiss, you know, what's actually going on. So it's not that I don't believe that she, like, I think she is fighting for her children and that these policies, but it's for a very narrow vision of which kids count, whose kids count, what a better future is, you know? And it's a white right. Christian nationalist but, future.
Yeah, very narrow and also very misleading. Like, this whole idea of returning to traditional, quote unquote, American values and like female roles and all of that is just, it's a fallacy. Like, it doesn't, that identity doesn't exist and it never has. And the attempt to sell it as something as the way things used to be is just false. Anyway, you sent me a video of Joy Reid kind of responding to Katie Britt, and she brings in this whole trad wife thing as well. Mm-hmm. And she talks about, like, she makes a juxtaposition at one point of the mother who was screaming at Ruby Bridges as she walked up the stairs to integrate schools. Mm-hmm. And then the picture of like a Leave It to Beaver family, which is seen as that whole ideal traditional family at that point in time. But then she brings up that when Leave It to Beaver was actually on TV, it wasn't even popular. It never made it past the top 30 shows at the time that it was actually airing. Didn't become popular till the 80s when it was parodied more for how blatantly ridiculous it was.
And I think,
as a show.
Think about politically in the 80s, what's happening in terms of conservative Christian.
Phyllis Schlafly.
Right. It becomes,
like, we've
I
been
think,
through all that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like it becomes a trope that it doesn't even really matter if it was ever historically accurate. You know, it's like a, some kind of aspirational thing. I don't know. I think there's also this sense, and I know we'll get into this more when we talk about all of these histories and these current things like trad wives, but this idea that in an editorial that Katie Britt wrote endorsing Trump for president in this current election cycle, she said that he will bring peace through strength because he already has. And I think there's an element of that too. I know, try not to like roll your eyes all the way back into your head. But I think
peace, that's what I've thought of since 2016.
Yes,
and him being at peace is definitely high up there on how I qualify.
Yes, right.
Time.
But the desire for like a strong man dictatorship sort of vibe, I think that's part of the narrative too, is like you.
Yeah.
Maybe you're giving up these things, but what you're getting is this like strong protector who will keep you safe. You know, there's, I don't know, like the psychology of it's so interesting. There's a bunch of guests that I hope we can get on to talk more about this who've studied all of this a lot. When I was hitting some walls and not able to find out as much about Katie Britt as I wanted to, then I started to have a bunch of questions about who else has been a U.S. senator who's been a woman. Do you mind if we pivot a little bit? Did you have any more you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
Mm-mm. No, I mean, I think there's a ton to get into with the trad wife thing, but we should definitely, we got to do a whole episode.
100%. And I promise in honor of that episode, I will at least shower. Seems
I
like.
I expect you in a dress nod. And full makeup.
A coif. Yes. I will do my very best. Yeah. Right now I'm like I'm so far away from that. Yeah. It's, there's gotta be like a parody social media version that's like bad wife or like something that rhymes with trad wife. That's just like, here's what it actually is. Like stink literally, figuratively. Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, still I'm happy and it's fine. Okay. So it was really interesting because when I was digging into it, so 60 women have served as U.S. senators in the history of the United States Congress, 6-0.
Okay.
25 of those women are serving right now. And of those 60, 17 are from the South, depending on how you define the South, you know, of course. But so a lot of women. And then I did want to shout out before we get into like shitty white women, the just who some of the women of color are who have served as senators. So the first woman of color to be elected was Carol Moseley Braun. And she was a lawyer, a diplomat. She was in the U.S. Senate from 1983 to 1999, representing Illinois as a Democrat. She was the first Black U.S. Senator for the Democratic Party, the first woman to beat an incumbent senator, because a lot of these early women in particular were appointed. So even being elected was a big deal. So, and she's the first woman senator from Illinois. Mazie Hirono is the first Asian American woman elected to the U.S. Senate. Catherine Cortez Masto is the first Latina elected to the U.S. Senate. She's your senator, right?
Yeah, she is.
Then Tammy Duckworth is the first Asian American woman elected to Congress in Illinois, the first disabled woman to be elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, the first member of Congress born in Thailand. And as a senator, she's the first person to give birth while in office, which, like, I don't know how she did that. I am forever, like, beyond baffled about how all of the logistics of that work. Just unbelievable. Mm-hmm. This is not a comprehensive list, but LaFonza Butler is just recently, like, oh gosh, like end of 2023, California's Governor Gavin Newsom appointed her to fill the Senate seat when Dianne Feinstein died. And so she was appointed, but she's the first Black lesbian woman to serve in the U.S. Senate representing California. As far as I could tell, no Indigenous women have been elected to the U.S. Senate. Charisse Davids and Deb Haaland were were elected to the U.S. House of Representatives as first Indigenous women to be in that position, with documented tribal ancestry to serve in Congress at all. But I don't think anyone has served in the Senate. Mary Peltola is Yupik, and she was elected a couple of years ago to serve Alaska in the U.S. House of Representatives. So she's the first Native Alaskan person to serve in Congress, but I couldn't find anybody else. So it's just such a small group. And just in general, not many women, like 60 women ever, you know, in the whole.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking, like, how many men?
I should have looked that up. It's like hundreds and hundreds, you know? Yeah. But even just thinking right now, there's 100 senators, 25 are women. That's the most that it's ever been. Like, I just. Yeah, I again, not to say that, like, if a woman were serving in the U.S. Senate, she would be advocating for policies that I would want. Clearly not.
Clearly not.
But it is just interesting. So the very, very first woman to serve in the U.S. Senate was actually from the South. Her name was Rebecca Ann Latimer Felton. We've actually referenced her before.
We talked about her, yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah, I remember.
She was a suffragist. So when we were talking about the white women who absolutely mobilized white supremacy to advocate for their right to vote, she was among them. Here is a quote from her in 1897 that she gave a speech to the Georgia Agricultural Society. She said, quote, "I do not want to see a Negro man walk to the polls and vote on who should handle my tax money, while I myself cannot vote at all. When there is not enough religion in the pulpit to organize a crusade against sin, nor justice in the courthouse to promptly punish crime, nor manhood enough in the nation to put a sheltering arm about innocence and virtue, if it needs lynching to protect women's dearest possession from the ravening human beast, then I say lynch 1,000 times a week if necessary." So what the actual fuck? Yep. She was appointed to serve in the Senate when she was 87 years old.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
No,
part.
I don't think I knew that part when we were first looking at this.
Ancient.
No kid, like 87.
Was she even alive back in that day?
In 1922, 87 years old. Basically, the governor who appointed her, the current senator,
feels like she'll die soon anyway.
Truly,
so who cares if we
it
put
was
her in?
Absolutely symbolic. So the current senator of Georgia died. The governor wanted to put someone in that wasn't that serious so that he could run for the Senate when, and then, you know, he would become senator was the goal. It did not work out that way, but that was his plan. And then it was 1922, so the 19th Amendment had just passed. And so he's trying to, like, gain support from the white women in the state. So he and was not himself known for supporting women's right to vote. And so he puts her, I know, shocking, he puts this 87-year-old, you know, activist into the position. She was officially sworn in and served, I think, a day. She was in D.C. for a few days and kept going to hopefully get sworn in. But the new guy had actually gotten elected. And so there were questions about whether she could be sworn in or what. So it sounds like it was all kind of symbolic. And so she gives one speech. And the quote, this is from her speech on the Senate floor. When the women of the country come in and sit with you, you will get ability, you will get integrity, you will get exalted patriotism, and you will get unstinted usefulness. And then served her day and then give, you know, turned her seat over to the guy who had been elected.
Wow. That is, we didn't get that much into that story, and that is fascinating.
It is something. Yes. Okay. Then there was Hattie Caraway, and she's from Arkansas. And she was the first woman in the Senate to co-sponsor the proposed Equal Rights Amendment in 1943. So just like a lot of these white Southern women who were suffragists, like, had like some elements of what they argued for were expansion for their rights, you know, but mm-hmm. not for anybody else. So she had like sometimes would support more progressive kinds of things, but then also joined many Southern senators in voting against anti-poll tax bills. So she was pro-poll tax, which, of course, was a tactic to prevent Black people in the South from voting. Yeah. And she opposed anti-lynching legislation because she viewed them as unconstitutional, like it went against states' rights, of course, which is your favorite reason for anything to happen.
Yeah, states' rights equals racism.
We could do whole episodes on all of these people. The next senator, all of these first women senators were from the South, white women from the South. The next one was Rose Long. She was the wife of Huey Long. She was also appointed, but Huey Long was known as, and this is when the Democrats were the party of the South and like the party of like upholding segregation and all that. And we've talked a little bit about how and when that switched, but he is like a really, really infamous political character for basically being like a fascist, like dictatory, demagogue, fascist sort of politician, in like a pre-Trump kind of dude. So when I was reading about him and reading about her, I was like, oh, this reminds me, not that Laura Trump is Trump's wife, it's his daughter-in-law, but it has the same kind of vibe. Like, his wife gets appointed. We really should do a whole episode about her and Huey Long, because their politics are really wild. And she was in Louisiana. And then Dixie Graves is the next senator. So again, all of these are white women from the South representing at the time the Democratic Party, which is like today's Republican
More
Party.
Conservative
right? So she was only in the Senate for 5 months, also appointed. Guess who appointed her, by the way? Any guesses about her relationship to the person who appointed her?
No, relative somehow.
Oh, in two ways. Her husband, her husband,
husband and first cousin.
Yes.
No, shut up. I was
no, kidding. I'm dead serious. Yes. Her husband's cousin, the governor, Graves. So her maiden name is his last name, right?
Make America great
yes,
again.
Yes, exactly. yes. Dixie, nicknamed Miss Dixie, she represented Alabama. And was, again, like a suffragist, white woman. She also, some of her positions are really interesting. She was advocating for women to be drafted in times of war, was really involved in the suffrage movement, and was the first woman to represent Alabama in the U.S. Senate. I went into a little bit of a rabbit hole with her and her husband. So because she's from Alabama, and that's the state that Katie Britt represents, let's wrap up with this lady and her cousin husband. Okay. So he was a really powerful governor of Alabama at the time, like the most formally educated governor of Alabama. Of course, like, because it's all literally incestuous, he was related to the Alabama's first and second governors. Like, it's just a very elite circle of people, like wealthy white people. He served in the House of Representatives. They got married in 1900 while he was serving in the state legislature. He, at this point, and it's not terribly different right now, it was really like there were no Republicans winning anything in Alabama. It was all Democrats. So the primary was really where the election happened. And there were considered like a more conservative and more progressive camps of this party. But we're talking about like the progressive wing of like the most extreme conservative group. So it's on the whole, yeah, not progressive the way we would think of progressive, but he was part of this more, quote, progressive bloc. He was supportive of the 19th Amendment. He was supportive of the temperance movement, which is something else we will have to get into, because that was a lot of white women doing a lot of activism to try to protect families and children, ostensibly. Mm. He had support from organized labor. It's some of his positions and some of Dixie Bibb's positions are really kind of complicated, because he was opposed to the convict lease system, which is a big part of Jim Crow. If anyone's seen the documentary 13th, it's how slavery like continues to exist just by different names. Like when you have super racist criminal justice system, and then you have something like a convict lease program where the prisons will like let you use their prisoners for free labor. Like that is slavery, you know, just by another name. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he was opposed to that, but because white union leaders thought it depressed the white workers' wages, because if you know, it wasn't like
if you can get free labor,
right, it wasn't,
then you're not going to pay
to defend like the humanity of the people in those situations. It was to say, oh, these white workers aren't getting paid as much now. He was very pro public school, but of course for like white children. Did I mention that he was a grand cyclops of the Montgomery Clavern of the Ku Klux Klan?
I'm shocked.
So the fact that he's considered like more
progressive
and was like,
but a grand leader,
that just tells you kind of where we're at. This line, this came from the Alabama encyclopedia that I was reading this in. Quote, he ran strongest among rural white voters in North Alabama and weakest in the Black Belt. And I was like, oh,
I'm
you
shocked.
Don't say. I'm real shocked. Yes. But he did a lot of like infrastructure spending, like paved roads, like that kind of thing. So a lot of spending to build schools again for white children. And so the more conservative branch of the party was opposed to him because they thought he was spending too much money, like spend now, pay later kind of vibe. So then he actually distanced himself from the Klan publicly for a while because it was getting some bad press. It's like so ridiculous to even talk about this. But it's like historians have looked back. They're like, oh, he stopped paying his dues for a while, but it wasn't like he never denounced them. And then he's actually connected. Have you seen or know about the Scottsboro Boys? Does that case sound familiar? It's this in 1930. Yeah. Long story short, we could honestly do a whole other episode about this. Scottsboro is in Alabama, and it's a really like infamous trial that worldwide people were watching and criticizing this group of teenage boys that were convicted for raping white women. And of course, it was all fabricated. And then there were all white juries and like multiple trials, and just like a really like horrific example of how racist the criminal justice system is and how deeply problematic. And there were some Supreme Court cases that influenced how juries are made up that came out of this. It's like, it's just a super, super famous and important moment in Alabama. And he was involved when their retrials were happening and never extended them pardons, like basically upheld the crumminess of the criminal justice system. So that was him. Although he was, again, this is where it's complicated, like really supported the New Deal and all of the like public expense
infrastructure,
works kind of things. So supported that. So Dixie Graves was a member of the Alabama Equal Suffrage Association, so super involved in that. She was president of the League of Women's Voters, also president of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. So one of those like classic, you know, white women who's super involved and active, but only to benefit white children. She proposed during her first week as a senator, she proposed a peace bill which called for both men and women to be drafted in times of war, and just saying like we all should pitch in and help in some way when we're countries at war. But the bill didn't make it through, obviously. She also gave a very passionate speech against an anti-lynching bill, so double negative there. So basically,
for lynching, supported lynching.
And it was the first time that a woman gave a speech on the floor of the Senate that attracted, like, that was like a policy, like a substantive, you know, actual speech. Mm-hmm. And she says in the speech that she thinks it's a horrific, like, oh, it's a horrible thing, but we cannot support this bill because it would surrender states' rights and state sovereignty. Thoughts about that position?
I mean, it's typical. Like, you know, we've said this a bazillion times in prior episodes. There's a lot of code words for, like, upholding white supremacy, and states' rights is definitely one of those things that always triggers, you know, that in my mind. That I haven't come across a states' rights argument that hasn't somehow been linked to white supremacy yet, I don't think. So
I know. Yeah. Exactly.
Not surprising.
So that's Dixie yeah. Graves. And she was also encouraging other women to run for political office. And just as a link back to Katie Britt in her kitchen, there was a speech she gave to really, like, rally women to run for office, and compared being involved in politics to it's just housekeeping on a larger scale. And that if more women enter the political arena, then the nation's housekeeping would be better. Anyway, that's that. So yeah, the first several white women who served in the U.S. Senate appointed, politically connected, appointed women from the South. So zero surprise about the kinds of things that they supported and advocated and spoke on. And also direct connections to who is currently representing Alabama today.
Yeah. Interesting. That was a good rabbit hole.
Thanks.
Well, I can't wait to get down into more of the rabbit holes that all of this brings up, because I think it's like so entrenched in this weaponization of white motherhood and white women and traditional quote unquote values and all of that. So, oh, there's so much to unpack.
So much. Please, yes. And shoot us emails or message us if there are topics that you are hoping that we cover. This is, like, all clearly very flexible.
We'll unbury them from our 11,000 unread emails.
Yeah, right. I know. That's, like, such a ringing endorsement of our ability to write back quickly. Yeah, we'll get to
that. Listen, send us a message on Instagram. That may be the least, like,
that Mandy watches.
Which also,
yes.
We have not updated our Instagram page whatsoever either. But I will see the messages there and follow us. And maybe one of these days we'll get updated on there as well.
Maybe it's us saying, like,
our Dirty Laundry podcast.
Disconnect from social media. That's great. Like, be outside, connect with real humans. And that's maybe we can couch our inability to accomplish those tasks as, like, a political statement. I think it's just us, like, not having time, but, you know, or not making time.
Yep.
I really want to look into Tradwives. So I know we've got that on our docket, but thank you for making that connection. All right. Have a great day, everybody.
All right. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.